Welcome to Bigfoot
and the Bunny.
This is a couple's journey into the mysterious,
the unknown,
and the paranormal. I'm your host, Chris Carr.
And I'm your host, Kristen Johnson.
Together, we are Bigfoot and the Bunny. Welcome to Bigfoot and the Bunny. I am your host, Chris Carr.
And I'm Kristen Johnson.
And we hope you guys had a fabulous week. We certainly did.
We did. We had our 1 year anniversary of our undisclosed location.
That's right. Among other things, but we won't get into all that. But yeah. God, I love this girl. Anyways, we investigated the undisclosed location once again this week. And we certainly have a show or podcast or both coming out for our recent investigation.
We have a great guest for you tonight. His name is Charles Christian, and he's an English barrister.
Which is to say, he's an advocacy lawyer.
And Reuters correspondent, turned writer.
Podcaster.
Radio show host.
Award-winning tech journalist.
And sometimes, werewolf hunter. Who now writes and talks.
Mainly about geek.
Tech.
Americana.
Folklore.
And the weird. He's awesome, and he has three books. A Travel Guide to Yorkshire's Weird Wolds, and that's spelled W-O-L-D-S. The Mysterious Wold Newton Triangle.
Saints and Sinners in Dark Age England.
Creating Imaginary Worlds, The 12 Rules. We started off our interview by asking him what a wold was, W-O-L-D-S. And this is how our interview began.
Ah, lovely. Yeah. Well, a wold is basically a series of rolling hills that are based on limestone. And as becomes clear in the book, the feature of limestone is that water tends to soak through it, and there can often be underground rivers that you're not aware of. That sometimes then fill up and break into life and come above the surface. And so you have river valleys that for 11 months of the year are bone dry and then suddenly are flowing with water. But I say it's the phenomenon of being based on limestone and the way the water sinks through it. And those are known as wolds. And Yorkshire has wolds at the south, and it has moors, which are again rolling hills, but they are based on clay and more conventional soils to the north, and they have an entirely different geology.
Interesting.
Yeah. I didn't realize they were two different things, the moors and the wolds.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah,
we
tried to look into that a little bit, kind of thinking we knew the answer ahead of time, but now you've enlightened us. So.
Yeah. I say that's the area I grew up in, and say to the north, it's the North Yorkshire Moors, very old, ancient, long occupied, largely sheep things. And to the south, it's the Yorkshire Wolds, which have a steep cliff at one end and a gentle slope at the other. And I say that determines that area's geography. And way the roads were and the way the settlements were and, in fact, the way that the legends and folklore grew up as well.
Sure. I imagine that they're pretty large and you can wander in them. And I know Kristen and I grew up walking in the woods and loved wooded lands. And it always has a sort of mystical feel.
It does. Wolves are a bit more agricultural, whereas the moors are lots of it because it's heather and just sheep, open tracks that you can wander along. And there is a long distance footpath called the Like Wake Walk, which is about 40 miles or so from one end to the other. It ends at the cliffs of the North Sea. And it's supposedly an old corpse way where people would carry the corpse of someone for burial, and they'd carry him across this way, which is where the wake part comes in it.
I see.
And it became a thing in, well, really took off in the 60s for trying to do the complete walk in under 24 hours, the 40 miles or so. I singularly failed to complete it, as the team I was with, we had compasses with us because you walk through the night as well, and a thick fog came down, but we didn't realise we were walking across ironstone, so our compasses were just making no sense at all. Wherever you look for north, the compass would be pointing north, and you say, this is the way we go, but we weren't. We just walked around in circles for several hours. It's also up there where the Filingdales early warning system is. It was built by the Americans in the 1960s. It was the originally golf balls. It's rather less attractive looking towers now, but it's still there. Living near it, we all thought, well, this is really great, 4 minutes warning.
Now, you said your compasses went awry. Could you tell us a little bit? Was it from the ley lines?
No, it was purely because we were walking across ground that had iron in it. And so it was the ground we were walking across was overpowering the compass. So instead of it pointing to true north, it was just pointing anywhere. We should have had better compasses. And obviously you wouldn't have this problem nowadays because you'd have your phone and it would show you the way to go. But I say it just, the compass needles just span around. But I say it was unfortunate that we hit fog, and it is an issue on the moors of encountering fog and seeing things looming out of the fog, and you think, is that a tree? What is it? And then you realize it's a sheep. There's a lot of sheep wandering around on those things, as they just let them out there for the year, and they just wander about. It's a very pretty, attractive area, and back in the Middle Ages there were lots of abbeys and priories there, the ruins of which many of them are still there, very spectacular ones. They made their money from sheep and the wool that came from them. So, that's a very, very historical area there.
I understand there's a lot of legends surrounding those wolds.
There is indeed.
May have a certain lycanthropic, if I'm saying that correct.
Well, exactly, tendency. Yes. The werewolf tendency. Yeah, now this is a fascinating one because werewolves in English folklore are actually quite rare. There's a little bit in Scottish, and there's been a couple of more recent reports of werewolves, but very much during, if you like, the internet era, where urban myths can spread a lot more quickly. But in sort of classical, looking through your folklore books, there's very little except for one called the Werewolf of Folkton. And this was a creature that was first reported in about the 11th century and then sporadically cropped up again a few hundred years later. And even when I was a kid growing up there, there was a report in a newspaper of somebody saying this huge wolf-like creature had been running along the ground near there. Now, what always fascinates me about folklore is the fact that no matter how fantastical the tale, there's usually an element of truth lurking somewhere at the bottom of it. And in this particular case, this area where the werewolf was first sighted was an area known for wolves. And indeed, there was an actual hospice built there, a hostelry, so that specifically to provide overnight shelter for travellers on the grounds that otherwise they might be eaten by wolves. And I mentioned the hills and the geography. The hostel is based at the bottom of a hill at the side of a marsh. So if you were travelling from north to south and to the nearest town, you had to come down one specific hill and then head along a track on the dry side of the marsh. And so any wolves hunting would know that's where their prey would be. So that's where they built the hostel. And this werewolf was said to lurk near there. And I say, it sounds as if it was people not realizing how smart wolf packs are. And, you know, we now have animal behavioral studies and we know the way they work and they know the way that a group of wolves can somehow signal to each other and they can cut off their prey, whether it's animals or people, and circle them and hunt them down. But of course, 1,000 years ago, people didn't understand that, and they just thought these wolves had some kind of supernatural power. And the theory was that, you know, they just couldn't be wild wolves. The theory was that, well, they must be, there must be some wizard or a warlock who scopes out the area and knows where people are, and then he changes into a wolf and joins the rest of the wolves and hunts them down. And so the legend of the werewolf began. However, there's two sort of interesting spins on the story. The first is that 1066, the Norman conquest and all that, big event in English history, shortly before that battle, there was an invasion by the Vikings, and they marched along that area. They landed on the coast nearby, marched along that way to a battle with the Saxons. And the leader of the Vikings was known as a berserker. He would wear a bear skin, a furry bear skin, and the berserkers would get themselves psyched up on alcohol and mushrooms and drugs and the like, and they would think they were imbued with the power of wolves and that they were killing machines. And you read reports of them running into battle without armor, just slaughtering everybody in front of them, and people were so terrified that rather than fight them, they'd run away. Now, along with the berserkers who wore the bearskins, there were also people who wore wolf skins, and they did the same thing. And they would have a wolf skin with the wolf skull on the top of their head, and they'd march around. And so it's interesting that the place where this werewolf legend grew up was an area that in historical times had an army that included people dressed as wolves who thought they were wild killing machines marching through there, generally wreaking havoc, as the Vikings did. So I'm wondering whether the two stories came together, that of the Vikings and that of the wolves that naturally predated the area. And so we had the legend of a half-man, half-wolf, the werewolf.
So it's thought that maybe the folklore goes back to the Vikings wearing the wolves and wolf skins.
Yes.
What kind of descriptions were given later?
When it was described as being very tall and that it would walk on its hind legs. But again, wolves and indeed big dogs can go on their hind legs, particularly if they're attacking, you know, jump up, and they have quite good balance. And it supposedly had a very large, strong tail, which was so powerful it could knock you over. And it had two bright red or orange eyes. And indeed, one of the later reports in the 1960s, somebody said they thought it was a car that was stopped in front of them and they could see the two red lights. It's only when they got close they realized it wasn't car tail lights, it was the lights, the eyes of a wolf. And the key thing about this wolf, it had apparently putrid breath, because wolves eat carrion, and so it was known as Old Stinker, logically enough. And the sort of the curious footnote is about 3 or 4 years ago, there were reports in the city of Hull, which is about 30 miles from where we're talking, and if you like, the far end of the Yorkshire Wolds, of a large wolf-like creature stalking some of the streets and stalking some of the along the riverbanks. There's a riverbank that flows through Hull, and it was thought that there were reports of a very large creature, bigger than an Alsatian, that was, you know, attacking people's poodles and fierce and had bright red eyes. And so there was a suggestion, was this old stinker who'd suddenly returned from the undead and was once more haunting that part of Yorkshire?
Interesting. And did you write about that?
I did. I actually got commissioned by a local newspaper to go on a midnight werewolf hunt. So there was me, my wife, who said thank you for inviting me. As we were standing in an abandoned churchyard at midnight while the newspaper's photographer was taking pictures of us standing next to toppled tombs, she said, remind me again how we got into this. As she would. And there was a local folklore expert as well. And we set out and we walked along the riverbank on the night of a full moon, looking to see if we could find a werewolf.
And did you succeed?
I wouldn't be probably here if we'd actually come up.
If all the reports of the lore crosses over a little bit with the breath and old stinker with sort of the Bigfoot and Sasquatch legends, where his breath is supposed to be so foul, it's one of the signs you've come across a Bigfoot.
I did not know that. Ah, right.
And some other cryptids as well.
Yeah. As you say, no, we didn't meet a werewolf, but we did see on the other side of the riverbank, and fortunately there was no way across for it, clearly a very large animal, I'm assuming a dog, with bright orange eyes, and you could tell by the distance they were apart, it was a big dog. And we shone our torches at it, and rather than run away or duck, it was definitely following us along the opposite side of the riverbank. And it was distinctly scary. I mean, I suspect to say it was a large dog that had gone feral. I'm sure you have the same problem in the US where people buy these great big dogs and then they become too expensive to feed, or they get out of control and they let them loose. Mm-hmm. And so this dog was on the prowl on an area around there. And I think that was the source of the sightings. Someone's large wolf-like dog. In the UK, there's been a craze in recent years for huskies and malamutes, big dogs like that, which are related to the wolf and wolf-like in size. So I think it was that. But as I wasn't putting my hand up to go across the river to get a closer look of
find
it.
Find out.
But I say, I think that was it. I think it was a natural phenomenon. I mean, what's interesting is a lot of the tales about how you deal with werewolves and things, a lot of them are actually quite recent and seem to stem from those movies in the 1930s, The Werewolf of London and The Wolfman and things, where, you know, you shoot them with a silver bullet, and when the wolf dies, there's a naked man lying on the floor and is reverted back to his human form.
Sure. American Werewolf in London was one of my favorite movies growing up.
Well, exactly. Yeah. And what that interestingly is, was shot. They were walking across the Yorkshire Moors when the wolf first attacked them.
Are they the same moors? Is that right? I didn't realize.
The same moors, yeah. Yeah, these are the same.
Okay, I remember that when they were walking, the two best friends, when they were walking through the moors.
Yep. And I say it's an area where, I say, fogs do come down very, very quickly. Visibility goes from crystal clear to very, very, almost zero. Very quickly. And I say you can get into difficulties on them. And I say it was a perfect location for having the wolf and the isolated pubs and things. They do exist up there and they are just like that. And the locals look at you and say, you ain't from round here, are you?
Yeah, we have some version of that in America.
So let's say you did find a werewolf, one that was behind you, or
yeah,
what would you arm yourself? What do you bring with you? You were talking about the silver bullets. Does that, is that's just a legend, a myth? How do you, how would you kill a werewolf?
Ooh, if you read the medieval, the Germans and French were great believers in werewolves during the witch trial era. And they were very much of the opinion that you kill them the same way you'd kill any large, fierce animal with a sword or an axe or a pike, you know, a long pointed stick, and then behead them. The silver bullet thing does seem to have come a lot later. And there's a famous story of the 18th century of the werewolf of Gerdan in France, which was a wild creature that killed animals and a lot of people and was hunted for a long time. And they eventually shot it, and it would appear, it's one of those murky stories where it's quite clear the people who were hired by the government to hunt it actually had a very large dog of their own, which they put bits of phosphorus on and generally made it look frightening and let it run around so as to keep the business going. But it does appear it may have been a captive lion that had escaped because of the descriptions of the kills. And I say they shot it just with a straightforward lead bullet. And that does appear to be the way you deal with a werewolf, that you just have to have something that allows you to keep a distance and to kill it with, which is a problem in the UK because obviously we have very strict gun laws, and you can't go out with firearms of any sort. But I was under the impression it would be a very large dog, so I took a very large walking stick with a very large heavy handle on it and a spike at the other end.
That's great. I don't blame you. I would do the same thing.
Yeah, you would definitely want to have some kind of weaponry.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, you read some reports and they say, you know, have a silver dagger and you stab it. Well, all the reports of wolves are they are big creatures. Wolves, they're big creatures with a long arm reach. So if you're close enough to actually stab it, it's close enough to bite your head off. So I don't quite see the value of that one.
Is there any tie-in to the werewolves in the wolves in the ley lines and forgotten ritual landscape?
There doesn't appear to be a link between them as such, but I think more of it is what intrigued me about it so much. Because I grew up in that area, and it was the, I had a friend who was a farmer's son who had a farm around there, would go round there often, and we'd sort of explore that area. And it was the realization when I first started looking, that started to piece together. There was so much mystery around, still is, a very sparsely populated rural area in a bit of a corner of England that most people drive past and never notice. You know, it's a rural area, and you've really only any reason to go into the small villages if you live or work there. For most people, you just pass through on a main road and you don't see any of it or realize any of the folklore there. And I say it was just the fascination of it all. And then the more I dug, I realized that there was a major ley line that ended there at a place called Rudston, which has a very tall standing stone in the, now in the churchyard, And that ley line goes all the way down to the south coast and crosses the St. Michael ley line, which runs from Cornwall to the east coast and from the Rudston end of the ley line. There's another ley line heading northwest that ends up with some standing stones in the north in the Lake District. So suddenly there was all these sort of links. And then again, the more you dig, you discover that there are some, you know, the standing stone was erected some 4,000 years ago. The area is full of round barrows, you know, ancient burial chambers. A lot of them have been eroded by farming, but there are hundreds of them. Some are only just have one small cremation burial in them. Others were multiple burials in elaborate chambers. And there was all that going on there. There were a thing called a cursus, and it's basically a track that's been dug out of the countryside, and it's thought, because obviously we're dealing with a time long before historical records, that people would of the era would hold possibly coming of age type competitions for youths around there. And, you know, they found lots of arrowheads suggesting that they had archery competitions and things of that nature. So there are all these little things going on there. There are a number of henges. They were wooden henges rather than stone henges. Mm-hmm. And you say, the more I scrape, the more I found more and more and more stuff. And you just think, well, there's this huge area of weirdness going on there, right? And it's been going on for thousands of years.
It's like, how did they know that was like the perfect place? How was it a feeling? Because they didn't have compasses, they didn't realize, you know, how did they know to do all that on those ley lines?
Exactly. How, you can sort of sometimes criticize later ley lines because the historical context is wrong, because you've got, you know, stuff that's from the New Stone Age, cheek by jowl with medieval ruins. But there was nothing else there, you know. And how did they have these links? And the stone that's in that Rudston, it doesn't look so impressive these days because a lot of it has sunk into the ground with its weight. Plus there's a churchyard around there. This was the Christian church's practice in England, that rather than destroy pagan religious sites, they would incorporate them into Christianity. And they'd say, you know, you always used to go and pray at the big stone on the top of that hill. Well, you can still go and pray at the big stone at the top of the hill, except now you're praying to the Christian God, not to the pagan God.
Right.
And at one stage, there was even a cross built onto the top of the stone. And I say, you can see photograph of this. It's most incongruous. There's this little English church with this huge pagan stone right next to it. And There were fossils on it, and the type of stone reveals that it had been dragged a very long way from, you know, 30 or 40 miles from the nearest suitable place.
Wow.
So that would have been a huge effort. And absolutely. when it was in its heyday, it would have been taller than any of the tallest stones at Stonehenge. And it would have been light coloured. So you'd have had this huge whitish-looking monolith, a bit like the Washington Monument, if you like, standing in the middle of all these rolling hills. So you'd spot it for miles. You know, it would be a major focal point.
Right.
I love the megaliths and various stones that are all through the UK.
Mm.
And the islands. And growing up and around that kind of environment, around the wolds themselves, Did you experience anything other than maybe just the environment being so powerful that made you feel drawn to this kind of folklore of werewolves and folklore in general?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose one of the things was I grew up in the era when, at least in the UK, television was relatively limited. We did have television, but it tended to be only on an evening, and it ended quite early on in the evening, and you only had one or two channels. And it wasn't quite the thing. So we still had, you know, we'd sit around the fire at Christmas, the coal fire, and tell ghost stories, or I'd listen to ghost stories that my, you know, parents and grandmother would tell. And my friends had sort of similar, you know, upbringings. And so we were conscious of it. And, you know, I was one of those boys who liked history. And the town I grew up in, Scarborough, is a coastal town. And there's a huge castle on the top of the cliff, headland there. And, you know, I used to climb around there. And the house we lived in was right on the harbour side. And there were strange tunnels underneath it. And I think it was largely because the buildings, as the town developed, the shore moved further and further. The development on the shore expanded. So a house would be built and then they'd stick another lump on the front as the land improved. And then they stick another lump on the front of that. But I say, it was a very peculiar house, and there were certainly some medieval bits in it, with later stuff bolted on it. And I say, odd tunnels and lots of legends in that area, because anywhere on a seaport town, everybody says the tunnels were where smugglers smuggled and stored their loot. So it's always that element of it. And
led to a lot of tales of hauntings and paranormal legends.
Exactly. And I mean, the smugglers in some areas deliberately encouraged these tales, and would dress themselves up to be scary so people would not think, oh, those are smugglers bringing in some brandy. That's a ghost or something, I can see. So, there were a couple of old pubs that were said to be haunted. And so I just sort of grew up surrounded by it, and took an interest in it from there on.
That's so interesting. So we're going to go back to the worlds here. The world Newton meteorite.
Yeah.
Is that close to the ley line?
It is indeed. It's because I call it the Wold-Newton triangle. Because okay. when I was putting this area, the book together, mm-hmm. I realized that all the tales were bounded by a major road to the west and to a big headland jutting into the North Sea to the east, and the two sides of the headland. And basically it made a triangle. And all the tales I was telling fell within this triangle. So that's where it came from. And sitting right in the middle of the triangle is where is Wold-Newton, the village of Wold-Newton, where in the late years of the 18th century, what was then the largest meteorite ever found in Europe came crashing to Earth one Sunday afternoon in December, and it happened to land on land belonging to an eccentric kind of person you'd get in a Jane Austen novel or something, an eccentric squire. And he recognized its importance and very quickly commercialized it and took it down to London and showed it in a salon, and people would pay money to come and have a look at it because it was so large.
How do you know the length of it, the width?
I haven't got the details in front of me, but we are looking something like a couple of feet long at its longest.
Which must have made a huge impact. It must have...
The crater.
Exactly. Yeah, it's still in the Science Museum in London, though they've sawn a large lump off it for research purposes. But it was big, and it came down with a great crash and buried itself several feet into the earth and flew up lots of mud and things. And it just so happened that one of the farm labourers was nearby and saw it come down. And I say there was much thought that it was the noise it made, that it was perhaps ships at sea having a naval battle, the noise of it.
Right.
So it was a big thing. And I say it came round right in the middle of this area, which sort of adds another dimension. Was it pure chance, or was, if you accept that ley lines are power lines of some form, you know, earth forces, was it somehow attracted to it?
I was wondering the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we've no way of testing it one way or another now with, over 200 years have elapsed since then. But it is intriguing that of all the places for a large meteorite to land, it happened to be there. I mean, it would have only needed to be 4 or 5 miles off course, if that, and it would have landed in the sea and disappeared and no one would be any of the wiser.
Right.
Sure. It's really interesting how certain areas like come up as triangles. Like we have a triangle and here in the U.S. in Massachusetts, where Chris and I are from. Kristen,
yes, I saw that on your Skype handle.
Yeah, the Bridgewater Triangle, you know, and it's kind of they're sort of like window type areas.
Portals
and like all sorts of things can kind of come through. You know, we have Bigfoot sightings, UFO sightings,
right, aliens,
lots of paranormal activity. It just seemed to happen in these specific areas. I think our triangle here is a little small and it should probably encompass at least a few more cities, but there is, and probably part of Rhode Island, because at least Rhode Island is very, very haunted and seems to have a high degree of, miscellaneous type sightings in comparison with other areas. Do you find that to be true of the wolves as well? There just seems to be a whole realm of things that happen.
Yeah, I do. Because I say it's the fact that it goes back so much in ancient history. You know, you could sort of ignore it as an urban legend if all the tales were of, the last 50 or 100 years or something. And things can easily spread around from, someone's fiction story gets taken seriously and people believe it's true. But these... You know, there was stuff going on there for thousands of years. There is just to the north end of the triangle. This is between the Wolds and the Moors. Now, I'm sorry for bombarding you with more geography, but there used to be a large lake bed. This later became marshy. And in this lake bed, they have found, and now we're going back to 10,000 years ago, really early, just after the Ice Ages in England, they found a lot of red deer skulls that had their horns cut off and holes drilled in the front of the skulls on the sort of nose piece so that they could be worn as masks. And they found a batch of them. And the theory is this again was shamanism, that people were going out hunting deer and they would wear these masks. The shamans would wear the masks to take on the spirits of the deer and, build themselves up to go out and hunt them. Sure. And, there's remains of an old lake village. Again, we're talking of, the new Stone Age era. And clearly people were living there and practicing their rituals there for thousands and thousands of years, and then became the monolith was erected, then all these henges and curses were erected. It was such a popular area for the burials, the burial mounds there. So again, you think of all the, given we know the area is relatively sparsely populated, why, if you were burying someone, would you take them to this relatively unpopulated area to bury them there along with another lot? And the sort of suggestion has to be, explanation has to be, because clearly this was some kind of ritual landscape for the local people of that time, that, you know, there was something magical about it, and you buried people with their ancestors in this magical place rather than somewhere else. Mm-hmm. So sorry, Chris, you were about to say something.
No, I think Kristen was just referring to the magical land, something we talk about out here in some of our older areas, but we don't have the history, or at least noted history, that the UK does. So when you say, you know, this area goes back thousands of years with legend, we, of course, being in the US, are missing some of that. We go back to the Native Americans and what they wrote, and that kind of ends there, you know, and apparently some Viking legends as well. Mm-hmm. But I know you know quite a bit about dragons as well.
Well, there is a curious tale. Cryptid. Legendary dragons. Yes, there's a curious tale about a dragon that was hunted down. There was supposedly a dragon that plagued this area. And again, it's where legend and geography overlap. And there is another headland called the town called Filey. And there's this spit of stone that goes out from the headland called Filey Brig. And it's sandstone. And the legend is that it was created by the bones of a dragon that had plagued the area and was eventually killed and left its bones there. It's one of the more unusual ways of killing a dragon. Because it was supposedly fed parkin, which is P-A-R-K-I-N, which is a peculiar Yorkshire type of food. It's a kind of gingerbread cake, and it's very, very sticky. It's ginger and treacle. There's clearly a bit of a mixture going on here, because you're talking about something that only existed a few hundred years ago, killing the dragon off. So it's, you know, people in a later date coming up with an explanation. But supposedly they left a great pile of parkin for this dragon to eat, and it ate it all. But because it's so sticky and chewy, it couldn't get its mouth open. So it went down to the water and tried to dislodge it all in the water, and accidentally drowned itself, and that's why its bones are left there. To say it's one of the more picturesque ways of killing a dragon. Doesn't involve a knight in shining armor running it through the spear. Right.
That's really cool.
Just a cook coming out with some large amount of food. I mean, it'd be and equivalent of I don't know, giving it the cone. The Coney Island hot dog competition you had yesterday.
Oh, right. You'd definitely win.
Yes.
Was that food that people ate normally, this parkin?
Yeah, but parkin. Very much as a sort of dessert, a pudding type thing you'd have. And you still get it, to still make it. And I seem to recall when I was a student at university in that area, there was a shop over the road from the university that made parkin, and I pretty much lived on it for 3 years. But
oh, no kidding! So yeah. It's still made today.
It's still made today. Yes, no, it's a delicacy, and I say it's treacle and ginger and flour. It's a very sticky, sweet type of pudding. But the English like their puddings like that.
And the dragon appears in many cultures.
It does.
I know there's that traditional sort of UK English, you know, like you said, medieval knight fighting this dragon with the wings, but it seems to have a almost global consciousness, whereas other cultures see dragons that are kind of similar, though different, or maybe in a different art style, seem to be the same creature. What is a dragon to you?
Well, I mean, that is the fascinating thing, that, you know, in England we've got dragons. All across continental Europe we have dragons of forms. China and Japan also have dragons. And there are some similar type creatures in the Native American and Mesoamerican traditions as well. You know, giant, fearsome, flying lizards, basically. I'm wondering whether one explanation is a sort of, again, I always like to look to see, well, where did it spring from? Because is it likely that there were these creatures that knights in armour were killing, and that they've all suddenly vanished and there's no record of them? Or was there something else? And I'm wondering whether it was the discovery of things like dinosaur bones or bones of, you know, the Ice Age creatures, giant bones, things like...
Right.
You know, if you're a farmer in a rural part of England and you came upon a mammoth skull with its horns and strange shaped skull and everything, you'd be completely flummoxed. You wouldn't know anything of what it was, and you'd think it was either something demonic or it was some kind of one of these mythical dragons people had talked about. The same goes for, you know, because people were digging in mines, mining activities that's been going on for centuries, they would have uncovered dinosaur fossils and bones. And again, these huge things, there'd be odd memories of some of the creatures that the Roman Empire had brought along for some of their circuses and things. Again, elephants and crocodiles and things of that nature. You'd have people coming back from traveling, you know, the likes of crusaders and things, traveling in North Africa. They would have encountered crocodiles. They'd have encountered rhinoceroses, things of that nature. What would they make of them? And a bit like fishermen, when they tell you how big the fish it was that they caught, but it got away. You can imagine, you know, 20 years after you've come back from the Crusades, Sir Drogo is sat there in the inn telling people, when I was in the Holy Land, I saw this dragon and it was this big. And the sort of tales spread along from there.
Sure, sure. I have to think too, like, you know, as was pointed out in that movie, The Witch, you know, the woods were a dangerous place.
Mm.
People in these days that we're talking about, you know, people would go in there to disappear or get slaughtered by like bears, wolves, things of that nature. It could be explained, but it'd be so horrific. They would attribute these things to things like witches and
dragons and werewolves.
And werewolves.
Mm. Werewolves, yeah. Creatures and you know, demons and things of that nature. You know, that they lived in a relatively black and white world where you know, it was the daylight world and you could see everything, and then it was night and of course there was no lighting other than candles. Long dark nights, no glow from street lights or anything like that. Just sheer pitch black, strange noises, strange flutterings and creakings and things that you didn't know. So you know, the legends would build up. And I say you'd particularly build them up where somebody goes outside in the dark and possibly gets carried off by a wolf or something. You know, the legends spread.
They sure do. I know people in Romania still fear vampires, you know, with every... these kind of sort of legends, there's always a little bit of truth.
Right.
Mm. Yes. And again, you know, I mean, in England, there have been, it's actually outside the Wall-Newton Triangle, but it's so close, it's almost in it. There's a medieval village called Warham Percy, and it was abandoned sometime in the, probably wiped out by the Black Death plague. But the archaeologists have been digging up the graveyard and they found that a number of the skeletons in the grave, in their graves, had been ritually desecrated, that their leg bones had been broken, mm-hmm. and their heads had been cut off, and their heads had been put between their legs, and the bodies would have been laid face down. And this was a fear that people had in medieval times, that bodies would rise from the dead, and they'd be called revenants. Nowadays, we'd call them zombies. Right. And there was this fear of that. And so, you know, if somebody had been wicked in their life, or hadn't received proper absolution from the church when they died, they might come back to haunt the living. And there's a lot of tales of these revenants coming back to plague the living. And so to prevent them coming back and walking, you would take steps when you buried them, to bury them face downwards, so that when the resurrection came, they were pointing the wrong way. This was the Christian idea of the resurrection, that you had everybody facing east and on their backs with their feet pointing towards the east, so that when the resurrection came up, they'd just rise out of their tomb upright and be facing the rising sun and the resurrection. So if you turn them round the other way, so they were facing down, they weren't able to do that. And obviously, if you chopped off their legs as well, then they couldn't stand up. Right. And if you cut off their heads, then they were further disabled from doing anything. So, say, they found this little sort of sleepy little hamlet, and a surprising number of the bodies had been ritually disabled that way. And again, going back to your Romanians, archaeologists there regularly discover bodies that older bodies in tombs that have in some way been protected, dealt with to protect the living. So they've put shackles on them or iron spikes through them and things to just keep them from rising from the dead. So again, this is another little element of which came first. Did the dead really rise, or were people frightened of the dead rising? And that gave rise to the legends of vampires and zombies.
Sure.
Which got another kick, I guess, in the 1800s with tuberculosis and the TB vampires. I know we have quite a few of those in our New England area. Legends, yes. Like Mercy Brown and whatnot.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, the fact that sometimes when bodies are dug up, they haven't decayed in the normal way, and you know, as you say, that they seem filled with blood. Another feature is that, which also crosses over with the werewolves, is that the hair can keep growing and the fingernails keep growing, and you also get the flesh shrinking on the fingers, so the fingernails look even longer. So you get reports of hairy creatures that have been buried with long talons, and you know, clearly werewolves of some sort. And I first encountered that tale actually from a girlfriend's father, and we're talking a long time ago, and he worked for the local council and used to do things like manual laboring in graveyards and moving, clearing up graveyards and shifting them and things around. And he came back one day telling of this tale, how they dug up a coffin, you know, a couple of hundred years old, that it was just full of hair and a strange skeleton all covered in hair. And, you know, it was definitely the impression it wasn't natural. And I say, once again, you know, with the advantage of modern science, or even if you don't have modern science, Google it, you can find natural explanations for a lot of this stuff. But you don't have it in bygone times, and you certainly didn't have it in rural areas. And so, you know, that tale that my girlfriend's father told all those years ago, had we been living 100 years later, that would have been already established as a, you know, there was a werewolf discovered there once by a gravedigger.
Exactly.
And it would have been passed story, out, you know? Yeah, passed down from generation to generation.
Our oral traditions, right?
We don't have enough of them in America. You know, you really need to go back. We have Beast of Bray Road, but, you know, a lot of the U.S. is taken up with Sasquatch and, you know, these Bigfoot-type creatures.
Yes. We do have a... That's another interesting one, the sort of the universality of the Sasquatch. I mean, you know, everybody talks about the abominable snowman or the Yeti in the Himalayas. But again, you get these tales of wild creatures living in the woods on the margins of society that are briefly glimpsed. And there's a lot of them in the UK. In this, where I live, they're called the Wood Woes. Wood meaning wood, and woes meaning, I think, wild man. So it's literally wild man of the woods. And you see them in church architecture, and, you know, over the front of the, by the church door, there will be this hairy creature with a large club and a big long beard and long hair, and lots of tales of these wild men that lurk. And again, still quite commonly referred to, and you still get sightings today of people driving along a road and saying, you know, some strange ape-like creature ran across the road in front of me and headed into the woods. So again, it's that interesting thing that it's got the universality of it, like the dragons. Are there some type of anything from a missing link in the human evolution, one of our ancestors, to some kind of ape that we don't know about living in these areas?
Sure. It almost like lives in the collective consciousness, you know, and from there it can take on a life of its own, it almost seems. It's like all the Slenderman sightings, you know, which was fiction, was purely an entry in a creepypasta contest or something like that. And then people swore they saw him afterwards.
Yeah. And I say with the Sasquatch and the similar creatures, you know, was it, you know, there's lots of different theories. Was it some kind of race memory for when Homo sapiens were still living in conjunction with the Neanderthals? Was it from medieval times when, you know, the invading armies would drive out and people who'd live there and they'd be reduced to living in the woods and on the margins of society? And, you know, I think also the human family is a lot more complicated.
And that's all the time we have for Bigfoot and the Bunny tonight. You can stay tuned to www.darkhorseparanormal.com to find out when we're going to release this interview in its entirety. We're going to delve deep into fairy lore as well as ancient civilizations. So stay tuned.
You can find Charles at www.urbanfanatists.com and at Weird Tales Radio Show everywhere you can get podcasts.
Next week, we have Rise Up founder Ken DaCosta on our show. And Ken is the best. I mean, this is a guy you go up to and say, you know, what's the weather like, Ken? And you come back learning something about the paranormal.
It's awesome.
We'll see you next time. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Bigfoot
and the Bunny.
We'd like to thank Joe Montaldo for his engineering and support.
Thank you, Joe.
Be sure to look for us on Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, and Twitter.
You can also find us at Dark Horse Paranormal and Purple Raven Paranormal by searching those very same outlets. You can email us at bigfootandthebunny@gmail.com. Thank you.
Catch you later.
Bye.